On your hire. I think you did really well.
We're going to call to order the task force on class size, and thank you for those of you who are joining us on the phone. We have a quorum, and we really appreciate you doing this at the end of a very busy August. At this time,
would you mention that? Two folks on the phone identify themselves.
Would the two folks on the phone please identify yourself?
Jeff Matsumoto in Forest Grove. Pendleton.
Thank you so much. At this time, we're going. I feel like I'm yelling, but at this time, we're going to start the informational meeting, and we're going to let you know that we have not received any more actual reports or letters at this time, other than what's up on OLIS. If you had a chance to look, we wanted to make sure from the last committee we were going to have a little bit of a presentation on the absentee report. We didn't get that in because it wasn't posted, but it is up on OLIS this time, and many of you have probably read that and have been through it. And the whole intent of this subcommittee was to acknowledge that sometimes we talk not about causes, but maybe about symptoms. And we've talked about the symptom of absenteeism. We've talked about the symptom of engagement. We've talked about the symptom of graduation rates. We've talked about the symptom of trauma. But many times we don't go back to look at the actual causes. And so the task force here today, and the one that has been working since late July, has been trying to look at the actual cause of some of these issues, and also other causes that have been brought to us around class size, and how a teacher wanting to do good work and doing excellent teaching and having an excellent ability to interact with students, that we really do need to look at the whole picture. And so that's why we're here today. I would like to ask if any of the members, either on the phone or here today, have any issues that they would like to bring up after they reviewed and thought about the agenda from the last meeting, or just some of the things that you've been thinking since the last meeting. Okay, at this time, then we have hopefully it's on OLIS and also in front of you. There is a preliminary report outline, and there are a couple things I wanted to talk about before we actually start the work session today, so that we can talk about this and also actually decide how we're going to go forward with our work. Because we were seated so late in July, we've really had a very little bit of time to kind of go through a very large subject area. We have research, we have data on the record that has been brought in both personally and also from the research that our staff has done with others. And we need to decide, what we want to do for basically a report out as required by the bill. And then we want to talk about if we want to go forward with some more work on these issues. And so at this time, you want me to open a work session? I'm going to open a work session. And we're here to discuss the outline, the preliminary outline, and also some of the other issues around it.
So, Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm going to run down to the witness desk. And if we want to edit the outline, I'll be down there ready to type. So okay. Just let me know.
So does anybody want to look at number one? It's what is class size, to try and define it. We talked about some issues around that. First of all, when we talk about class size at the state level, we often talk about averages versus actual sizes of specific classes. But we talk about averages, and sometimes it seems through the data and also through the testimony that really doesn't tell the whole story. I brought in at the beginning of this particular session the quality education model, because that's something that the state legislature has agreed upon. We have a committee that works on it. We have a report that comes every 2 years. And so talking about how the quality education model acknowledges class size, and does that, is that part of the definition that we as a state, actually look at? was something that we discussed and we talked about. We had a wide variety of stories from actual practitioners in the classroom that told us about some of the differences depending on age, depending on style of learning, depending on configuration of classes, and also something about subject matters as far as differences between subject matters. So we were going to make sure that we laid out what some of that dialogue was. Yes.
And I apologize just because I'm so new to this process. I was really impressed by some of the information that Brian provided in terms of the charts that showed the distribution of class sizes, because it starts to illustrate the impact on the large numbers of students. You know, we have more than 75% of students or something, you know, a large number that are in what I think nationwide we would consider to be extremely large class sizes, over 25 or 26 students. And I think that those charts start to define that and get away from some of the discussion that you're suggesting, which is about those averages and how distorting those can be. So I would hope that our report would include some of that baseline data as well as the sheer numbers of students impacted by these sorts of things.
Okay. Thank you very much. Other comments on the number one? Because number one is supposed to be a foundation of where we are coming from as far as what is status quo, and also as far as what is the total definitional aspect of this particular area.
So I have a question. It seems like every year, I know every year, they have these certain time frames in districts where they say, what's your actual number? Mm-hmm. And it's seats and chairs. It's not how many we think we have to. It's very clearly right. I have 22 students in chairs today. Mm-hmm. And they take that information, but I don't really know what they do with that information. Because then I think it comes back and says, now your average class size is because of all the staff in your building. But if they're asking specific teachers, you know, how many bodies are in your room, why that isn't what's presented more as class size versus averaging it out with all your staff, since they're gathering that information anyway.
Brian, did you want to respond
well,
to that?
Well, we do collect that. We mm-hmm. collect the number of students in each classroom. And when we talk about average class size, we're not taking the total students in a building and dividing it by the total teachers. We're only dividing it by the teachers who are actually in classrooms. So it is an average in that sense, yeah. But it's not averaged over all teachers. It's only averaged over teachers who are actually teaching a group of students in a classroom.
Do you ever average it by grade levels, for example, throughout the state? Kindergarten throughout the state, is it this? I mean, if you're going to average anyway, do you do that as well?
Yeah, we can do that. We have the data to do that, absolutely.
I
really think, though, given that we have so much variation in class sizes around the state, that truly these averages mask the important information. And the important mm-hmm. information is the range of class sizes that we have, particularly when we have very large class sizes in some places. And we know that we have very small class sizes in certain places, primarily in remote districts mm-hmm. that have really small schools. And so those circumstances tend to bring down the average, but those circumstances, by bringing down the average, they're not really telling us that we're doing better in terms of getting class sizes down. It still leaves those really large ones. It offsets, it sort of fools us into thinking that we don't have a lot of large classes, right, when in fact we do. Looking at individual classrooms is the best way to understand these data.
And am I remembering right? Those charts that you provided showed exactly that.
Yes.
Right? That we had, you know, so many that were so large, and then, you know, these other ones that had one or two that really can
exactly
skew the data.
And you know, it can be a little difficult in understanding some of these, because when you see a classroom that has one student in it, and it's in an elementary school in the Beaverton School District, you know that's not right. Mm-hmm. That's not really a classroom with a teacher and one student in it. It's some other circumstance. And so we need to be really careful the way we look at the data we have. If that classroom happens to be in 00 school district, mm-hmm. it probably is right. working with these data can be tricky sometimes, but we have enough detail now that I think we can remove those anomalies But again, looking at the distribution sort of helps us overcome those problems.
Yeah, I thought it was really helpful.
Yeah.
Just because I'm trying to be informal, and this is kind of an awkward table. When you guys were gone, we went to a square table. It worked a lot better. Yeah. But I want you just to say your name right before you give a comment, and then we'll try to be real informal and make it more of a conversation and not me recognizing everybody. So I'll just...
Hannah, and so I think... Yeah, having the actual numbers is really helpful so we can see, and I think that that's a great step. But the TEL Oregon data that we have on class size, I think, and the impact that that's having on teachers' ability or their perception, because that's their perception of can they meet the needs of all students. But if I think that's, I don't know how much you've looked at that, and I apologize for bringing it up if you already talked about it. But in defining class size, do you want us to come up with the definition? Is that what you're looking for there, or is that just it will be there?
Well, I think that we have a class size definition in, you know, with some of the work with the quality education model, and so I wanted to at least reference that or acknowledge it, and I also wanted to acknowledge that the work that Brian just was talking about, that there are actual numbers that have been collected on how many students are in a classroom with a teacher.
Yes.
Right.
And then that there, we do also use a variety of averages, which can be aggregated in a number of different ways, but that we want to acknowledge it, because otherwise we get the problem that Brian talks about, which is that we're fooled into thinking that we don't have large sizes or we don't have an issue. And so just to be very clear about what we have in the way of information about class sizes, one teacher, how many students in the room. You also have mentioned many times that sometimes we have other staff in the room. And when you're talking about other staff in the room, that's different than having other staff in the library or other staff in the office or other staff somewhere else that are not with those kids or helping those kids or supporting those kids at that time. Mm-hmm. They may support them in different ways at different times for different reasons, but what we're talking about is actually what's happening, you know, in the classroom at that time.
And even Hannah, yes. Again, so even if you think about the kindergarten teacher that I've referenced several times, 58 students in her classroom, she had up to 10 instructional assistants rotating in and out mm-hmm. of her classroom. She was responsible for 58. That the impact on those students is they had one teacher that was responsible for them throughout the year. So that, and I, you know, we started in 2013, right, collecting the actual data on class size and not using the averages or adding in specialists and all of that. So I don't know how many other states do that, but I think we are at an advantage to be able to say, here's exactly what we have.
This is Colin. I think we, in the definition, I think we would be do well to explain the difference between class size and student-teacher ratios, and I think that would kind of help in moving everything forward that we're dealing with class size and not the student-teacher ratio, which sometimes can make people feel a bit better about how things are.
Paula?
Yes.
I just was, you know, driving here, and I was trying to think. I have three children, and my oldest one started when the QEM model came out, and she went all the way through her public school education, graduated from college, and is in her master program, and we still haven't got there. Mm-hmm. And I think about those kids, that's a long span of children that have been living under these kind of situations of, you know, budget cuts and large class sizes and things like that. So I think it's important to put in perspective just how long we've been kind of been grappling with this and where we should be and where we're not. So,
and I think that was one reason, Susan, the chair, that it's my feeling that this report is, again, to acknowledge that we do have a quality education model, that it's there, that we've agreed to it, that we know what it means, but that we have to support it in real ways, and that we're trying to do so. We know we have financial issues. We know that as a state, we want to put more money into education in a real way that's going to impact the classroom and the teaching model. But it's important for us if we're going to keep going forward and have steps to go forward, that we have documentation and or reports that, again, acknowledge, yes, we believe in the model, yes, we need to go forward, and what do we need to do to address these issues, both cause and symptoms. So I appreciate you taking the time to help us, you know, try to do that.
And I had a, Colin, one just caveat, I guess, on the student-teacher ratio picture. I think we need to acknowledge that that discussion differs for elementary versus secondary schools, because at a secondary school, its class size is actually maybe not as important as the student-teacher ratio, because you know, there are ways to put very small classes in, but have a teacher teach so many classes in a day that their student workload is through the roof. And so an individual student might not see it, but the teacher might have so many papers to grade that it would be deceptive. So it is, I guess, we just need to be careful as we make sure we accurately represent what the teacher experience is there, because that's, in the end, this is what it comes down to, is their ability to provide an excellent education for all the students. And
how would I write that, Madam Chair? How would I describe it? I'm trying to keep it accurate.
I just think if I was writing the report, I would just put them in two separate sections as part of that discussion. I mean, I just...
So you're talking about workload?
Well, it's... Hannah, yes. And it's about relationships. And when we talk about dropout rates, you can't build a relationship with students when you have at a high school level when you have, 290 on your caseload or your workload or your class assignments, and that is an important part at the secondary level, just as it is at the elementary. But it's different, and I get what you're trying to separate that.
So we're talking about the accumulative effect of workload as it relates back again to effect on students. So how it affects both teachers and the students in the classroom, sometimes in a remote way maybe?
When it really gets back to Hannah's point earlier, Anne, again, of how many students is that teacher responsible for, right? Mm-hmm. You know, there might be a PE specialist and a music specialist and an art teacher at your school, but ultimately if a kindergarten teacher has 60 students in their class, those other specialists are going to maybe make the student-teacher ratio change, but it won't have that same impact at the middle and the high school.
I'm sorry, Hannah, again.
Yes.
So just on that point around the high school, so you got, if you have a language arts high school teacher and you really want feedback to students on their writing is super important. If the larger your caseload is, the more students you have, the harder it is to do long writing assignments where you can actually give them quality feedback. It is one of the things that educators talk to me a lot about, is my ability, I really want to be able to do creative things. And what you can do when you have, in an elementary school, if you have 18 in second grade versus 32 is amazing. And same goes with a high school. The number of students that you're seeing impacts the amount of time you can spend on each one of those students, whether it's face-to-face in the class, 50, you got 30 seconds. Hi, you know, and then you're moving on to the next student if you want to touch each one of them that day. So.
Apollo, I'm not sure how you capture any of this or if it fits in a definition, but, you know, in our district alone, we've done where we've interviewed all the students or we've had them fill out a questionnaire and we asked why dropout rates, what keeps you in school, mm-hmm. what makes you want to leave. And then we also do this thing at the end of the year where your top 10 students recognize a teacher that's made a difference. And a lot of times it's in those smaller arts classes, the ones, mm-hmm. because they get to build a relationship because those class sizes tend to be a little bit smaller. And I was watching that the other day and I thought, wow. That's interesting because they do get a chance to really know their students' lives. And so when the students were speaking about them, they're talking about how they knew them, mm-hmm. how they encouraged them in a way that was different than your writing, your math, and your science. Those are so big that the kids don't always pick those as the teachers that make the difference. Also with that, the students all said it really truly was not wanting to let their teachers down. It was the relationships they built that kept them in school. And I thought that was critical because That is it. Those kids do not. They build these relationships, and they don't want to let their teachers down. And if the teachers can't get to those kids, and they lose, you know, five or six kids every single time in a class because they didn't get so big. What happens to those students? So
appreciate that. So how does number one look as far as a foundation for the report to clear up what is the basic topic area and definition?
Is that first book? This is Anne. Is the first bullet point meant to describe the reference to the QEM meant to describe what we think our target should be?
Mm-hmm. At this point, we have skirted around that topic. You know,
sorry.
I mean, seriously, we have, and I think it's something that's sort of the elephant in the room, mm-hmm. and it's a situation where, again, I think this is basically an interim report in my mind. Because I think we need to have more conversation on that. I think we all have ideas, and I think we all have support for our ideas, but it's a situation where I'm not sure this preliminary report, we've done enough discussion on it. I mean, that's my feel, and I would love to hear from you folks.
Hannah, all of the work that we've done to talk with Oregonians, whether it was the OEIB, mm-hmm. whether it was the work on Oregon Rising, whether it was forums that we've had across the state to talk about schools our students deserve, parents, students, educators, community talk about class size mm-hmm. and how they want us to have class sizes that allow us to provide a quality education to each student. So I don't think it's too bold for this committee to say we have an issue and we need to address it. And although it's a very expensive issue, it's something that if we truly believe that every student deserves that education that prepares them for success, then it's something that we as adults have to step up and address. So.
This is Colin. I don't want to kick the can anymore. I think this is really our shot to say this is what class size in Oregon needs to look like, and here are all the reasons why. And now's that time. That's what this task force was brought together to do, and that's what our charge is, and that's what I think we should come out doing.
Well, as a chair, that makes me very happy. I mean, I wanted you folks to say that because, I mean, that was the goal. But it's just, I need to make sure it's a committee feeling for this report. Yes, please.
This is Darren. I totally agree. I mean, as a superintendent, as an administrator, I mean, I don't think there's any other way to be more effective than to have smaller class sizes. That said, right, if you go ahead and make a report that just says that is the single biggest reason why, because in our Oregon Rising process, that's not what our community said. Our community said, yeah, that's important, but what's really important is quality teachers, quality administrators. We want really good people. And while I'm all about making sure the class sizes are smaller in a medium-sized school district, that's something we get to work on. At the same time, I think if when we make this report, if we don't acknowledge some of those other pieces, it becomes a report that others that don't agree just write off as something that's, yeah, we've heard that before. So let's acknowledge some of the other pieces around it and build a very good argument in the report about why it's so important. And so that we can refute some of the responses that we get on a regular basis.
That's absolutely perfect. I really appreciate that comment because, again, that's why we're here again.
Right.
And that's to acknowledge, again, what those other connected
yes.
and integrated right. issues. If you want quality education, we've got to talk about this.
Right. If you live in a rural community and you begin to talk about a class size issue, mm-hmm. my constituents, my community members are going to smile and nod and go, we've heard this all before. This comes from people from the metro area that want to talk about class size issues. What we really want are quality educators. Mm-hmm. Now, you can get into the, yeah, but that's all connected, but it begins to sound a little bit like an excuse. So all I'm telling you is when you listen to other people beyond the people that we regularly listen to, right, and our job is to listen to all those people, right, we need to be able to figure that out. Now, those of us that work in education on a daily basis totally recognize that a small class size relates to just the very, very same things we were just listening to and putting up on the board, yeah. And that's important. So my suggestion is let's be smarter than that. Let's come up with a way to talk about all the other issues that might be raised, but say at the pinnacle of this is a class size issue or relationship issue that makes the difference. When you talk about it in those terms, it's very difficult, even for my community, to smile and nod and not at least acknowledge that that's an important piece to the puzzle.
Thank you.
Can I ask, yes. Darren, I don't know where you're from.
Cascade School District, just outside of Salem.
Okay, and how many
students? 2,300 kids.
2,300
You know
students.
Where Willamette Valley Vineyard is?
Yeah.
You know where the Enchanted Forest is?
Yeah.
Then you're there. You're okay. In my district.
So, and you're saying that in your community, are your class sizes low, high? Where are you?
In the middle. We're somewhere between 20 to 23, 24, and the K-3, 24 to 27. 3-5, and then in the junior high and senior high, we are running somewhere between 25 to 28. We start school on Monday. But the flip side of that, and some people would suggest that 28 is a little too high for high school in a trimester system, right? But at the same time,
whoa, like you mean low
28, yeah.
People that suggest it's too high.
Yeah. So
when I the flip side for me is that I can say on a regular basis over the last 5 years, we average about a 90% graduation rate.
Right.
So we spend time having that conversation about making sure that's what it is. And trust me, our teachers, our very best teachers, remind me on a daily basis, just Tuesday when we went through all of our in-service day, sure be nice if our class sizes were a little lower. We could really get some really good things done. Right. So that's the trick. Now, how do my constituents reflect on what somebody like, you know, Matt Utterback's my great friend at North Clackamas, right? He and I talk all the time. We've known each other for 25 years. That's a long conversation to have at North Clackamas about what size your class sizes are when I'm out in a rural area. Now, we don't pay the same, so there's a question of livelihood and where you want to live. And, you know, his commute is about cars and stuff, and my commute is about getting around, at the moment, tractors and combines to get to work. So there's this question about how does that fit, but we got to make sure what we're talking about this is to get some of my constituents to understand what it feels like to be in a classroom that is 44, 46, and even as close as 14 miles away, Sprague or South Salem, they do. So that's a tough conversation to have.
Yes, please, Brian.
This is Brian. I just wanted to agree with Darren. We tend to talk about these kind of inputs, you know, class sizes versus teacher quality versus other things, sort of one at a time,
right.
And not recognizing fully that, particularly in an endeavor like education, those are joint inputs. You know, you can't really talk about them as individual things. They work together, and so, you know, unlocking the real power of a great teacher maybe can't happen if there's 44 kids in the classroom. Their real advantage is lost
right.
when you're in that situation. So it's, you know, there are trade-offs between different inputs, but they're not perfect. You can't make up for really high class sizes just by getting better teachers. It doesn't necessarily work.
Right.
But I think the other thing we need to recognize, and this really gets back to local control, is that the, you know, how we deal with some of these issues and problems that we have are going to be different in different places. And they may be radically different in different places because we just face different issues. So, you know, coming out and saying, oh, you know, reducing class sizes is the best thing that every district can do to improve their outcomes, I think that's a mistake. I think we need to be a little more nuanced and upfront about the fact that in some places class size is a huge problem, in other places it's not. In some places it's not a problem at all.
And you're saying basically, I apologize, Darren again, I think one of the ways to go back is the QEM model. I mean, over and over and over again, right? You have a QEM model, a model that exists that's essentially average across the country. I mean, that what you're getting is an average. We're not even close to that. So my reality, our shared reality should be
hey, there's a suggestion there. If QEM is suggesting class sizes between 17 and 20 for K-2 and 20, you know, whatever the numbers are, that's the target I believe our committee should start to focus on. Mm-hmm. Because you can desegregate it out. You can have a conversation about, is it class size? Is it student-teacher ratio? Is it, how do you add? I mean, those numbers I gave you, I don't include my PE teacher. I include classroom teachers only. I want to know how many faces the people that work with me have to deal with every day. And it's one of the reasons why we made those adjustments, but it's important.
Before I recognize you, Anne, can I make a comment to something Brian said? What you said, I agreed with 90%. The one thing that I want to make sure that I understand on what you said, it's not that class size doesn't make a difference in rural areas. They already have smaller class sizes. And so the report needs to acknowledge that they have smaller class sizes. And I also want to acknowledge what you said. When you're living in central or eastern Oregon, transporting the kids to school, to be able to get them to school, you've got to worry about transportation dollars. When you're in an urban area, the transportation costs may be less because there's a shorter period to go, a shorter mileage to go, or there may be more resources. Maybe there's a TriMet bus or something like that. But, right? That's what you were saying. You were just...
Absolutely. I didn't mean to imply that class sizes don't matter in rural areas. What I was trying to say is that a lot of those schools already have class sizes that are around 10 or 12,
okay.
Some of them even smaller than that. And mm-hmm. So in that sense, I would argue that they don't have a class size problem because they already have pretty small class sizes.
This is Jeff. I would say in those instances as well where they might have the smaller class sizes in that general sense, by grade level, they might have a necessity to other issues involved, the blending of classes, right? And so you're absolutely right. There's a lot of blended things, that interactive things, but this is a class size issue. I think that we know the importance of that, and that's what I love about, I think what Darren was referring back to is our QEM. You know, the stronger we can get to numbers of 17, 20 in the K-1, I mean, that, wow. I'll say a colleague of mine just, again, said it's not that I would end up doing less work with a classroom of 20, per se. He said that my work would look different. I'd be able to do so many more things with a reasonable class size of 20. And then from the relationship standpoint, again, with higher numbers, that to me is always important. I think to every educator, when we listen to our kids, it is the relationships they form. And then finally, I'd ask, is there a way to see an interactive view of the document that you're producing, Richard, or not?
Madam Chair, Mr. Matsumoto, there really isn't.
Jeff, what we'll make sure we do is, can we make an email? Can we please send out emails to everybody who's not physically here?
We could text them a photo.
We could, okay, or text them a photo or something like that. We could do that.
When? What do you
well,
mean?
I mean, well, like, now, Jeff, can
now?
We do it after the meeting, or would that work? Or
That's fine. I mean, that's however it looks. I just know that again, when you start talking about some of the things that are getting inputted into the outline, I don't know if there's a way to do it. I mean, I know that they Google Docs, right? You can see it there, but anyway, I'm not there, so I can't do that.
Madam Chair, Mr. Matsumoto, one of the challenges of that is the legislature doesn't have an IT setup right now to permit that sort of thing, and so we actually don't have clear work orders for how to handle a situation like that.
What I promise to do is make sure that both of you who are on the phone and everyone who is not here is going to get a copy of this through email when we finish. And
great thing.
And all of us will, and that way we can be working.
Madam Chair, we'll post it on the OLIS site.
Okay.
Because this is a work product. I mean, it can go right up.
Right. So it's a work product. We'll put it on OLIS. Thank you. Yes, Paula.
So I'm thinking back to the QEM, of course, and we've put this together. It's a model. It wasn't an accident. A lot of work went into that. 20 years later, we're still not really even addressing the class size. But we did address, I remember 10 years ago being in a course as a teacher and someone saying, it doesn't matter how many kids you have in the classroom if you don't have quality educators. And that was their focus. So they brought in coaches, and we were flooded with coaches. So now we have a lot of staff that don't work with kids but work with teachers. And they've given us all these things to help us be better teachers, and they're still in place instead of letting us fly. They still are there doing these jobs where really, if they were focused on having quality education, they've done so much work around that. But no one's come back around and done the work with students. So I do believe, if I agree with you when you say you can't just be just class size and lousy teachers. I mean, we have to have quality educators in place and administration and all those things. And that's where we've put a lot of time and energy in this state. At least, I don't know in rural areas, but I know in the metro area, that's a common thread amongst all of my colleagues out there about how much teacher training continually goes on, taking us out of the classroom at times so that we can be better teachers and not teaching our students. And so when I heard that a long time ago, that it didn't matter how many kids, they've chosen to take that back and say, well, I guess it does kind of matter. Sorry we said that. But that was a big thing that really took a lot of teachers, like, right out of the, we're like, we're done. So I think that's important as well, because I think we've put some money there. Now we should put the money with the kids.
The TEL data supports that notion very strongly. And so I hope in our discussion about the value of quality educators, we discuss the input that teachers have. It shows a strong correlation between their perception of their ability to serve their students and the class sizes. You know, at least in our district, because we're fortunate enough now to have that data over a series of time during our worst class size years, you can see that data on all measures was much lower than when we started. And they're still bad, but the class sizes are not horrific. And so all of the teacher feedback started to rise a little bit. It really does impact the quality of education that they're able to provide, and we have strong numbers that support that. The other thing that I think is important, well, I guess I have two other comments. One is, I think when we talk about this, we really should be focused on the numbers of students impacted by large class sizes. If we look at as a state, we see that far too many students are impacted by large class sizes. And instead of talking about why it's not a problem in this small school district, we really should be focused on what percentage of Oregon students really should be facing this issue, and it's way too many. I have a quibble about this notion of local control that sort of makes it sound like we're choosing to have big class sizes because we're in a big school district, and that's not the fact at all. We are choosing to because that's the amount of resources we have, and we have a lot of schools to spread it across. You know, it is a difference in size of district and resources allocated by the state, but it has not very little to do with the amount of local control that we have. So I would like to see that language changed.
And that even goes, Hannah, and that even goes down to the building level, because mm-hmm. I know at Ridgewood, when you're allocated so many FTE, and then you have to look at where your students are, and you make a choice. Well, fifth grade's going to be a little bigger, because if we don't, our first grade's going to be 32, and we know that at the primaries, or we believe at the primary level, that's most important. So you have to make choices because you don't have the ability to actually have all classes be what you think they should be. And then I think on the local, yeah, there are a whole bunch of other issues. How many students you have with special needs, how you make sure you meet all of those needs of students. And the other thing that I just want, we've talked for years in Oregon about equity and about an opportunity gap, an achievement gap, whatever you want to call it. And yet we have far too many of our students who have a great need in classes that are way too large, and we're not addressing that. And I think as a committee to point out that, you know, yes, there is absolutely local control. We believe in that. And we need to lower class sizes for our students with the greatest needs. And we need to make sure that we are addressing those issues by providing funding that allows districts to do that.
I was hoping to acknowledge also, Susan Chair here, that when you talk about taking down numbers to help other groups or other classes or other needs, you also are affecting electives. And CTE and STEAM and STEM and those other classes that are supposed to bring engagement then are either dropped or limited or are very, very large. And like in speech and debate, I told you we had like 42 students in a speech one class. You know, and so I was just thankful they didn't drop that class. So getting 42 in that class, they did not get the same quality, they did not get the same relationship, they did not get the same feedback, but at least they got the opportunity, right? So you get half of the loaf. But it's a situation where I think that the report should actually acknowledge that as well, that it's, you know, when we take from one, as Hannah was saying and Anne was saying, then we, you know, we're giving to someone else at the expense of the other group or of the elective or anything else that we're having to do away with or restrain in some fashion.
Hey, this is Gary.
Hi, Gary.
I'm glad you brought that up. Dealing with larger class sizes in the elective areas, especially in our CEs, not an elective, but they're dealing with huge numbers, they're dealing with large numbers in our electives, whatever limited electives we have now. Due to the fact that exactly what you're saying, when we have huge language arts classes, social studies classes, or math classes, then they're taking those teachers also and putting them into an intervention course for the kids that aren't making it in those huge classes. So that takes away resources again, instead of expanding the teaching force to get class sizes smaller to address those issues in the one class instead of multiplying it out. We're eliminating a lot of electives just for the fact we've got to have interventions. So those are issues that come up with this as we reduce one size. You got to put the kids somewhere, and so they get added to a course that is already overloaded and becomes extremely overloaded.
Thank you very much, Gary. I appreciate that. So,
Chair, yes. Of the committee, a couple of things. I'm trying to put the electives thing and another part of the outline under effects, and I don't know if that's what everybody intends. And Ms. Brown, you're talking about changing the local, I'm trying to find it here,
the local control.
Here. So this is all my language, because I'm trying to keep up with the committee discussion, but I put on the side of this document kind of line numbers over here where they won't appear in the final outline. I would love it if you'd be quite explicit about what you want me to type. So literally, you know, line 18, delete whatever and type out something else. Mm-hmm. That'll help get there, because I'm trying to summarize, but maybe I'm not getting it right. And then the last thing that I wanted to say was, Mr. Matsumoto and anybody else who's on the phone, media has changed that they're pointing. The camera's not at the dais any longer, which is typical, but at the screen, so...
Perfect. I love it. Thank you so much.
Yeah, if you're streaming,
yeah, you should be able to see it. I was going to comment. Yep, I got it there.
Great.
So, based on what you just said, Richard, on line 24, it says, in some places, class size is a huge problem. In other ways, that should be in other places. It's not... And what I meant by local control there is not that...
I was the one who typed local control first. I know
well,
we
and
said
I,
local, I put it there.
No, I said I did
me,
say
so,
it.
Yeah.
But
he did.
What I meant by that is who decides how resources get used at the local level, not that local districts or schools could have smaller class sizes if they simply chose to do that.
Would it be fair to say impact of decisions on FTE, sort of decisions of FTE?
My point, though, I think, is you don't really want the state making those decisions because they're not in the best place to do that.
If the state came
in and said every district needs to reduce their class sizes by 3 students, some districts would say, we don't need to do that. That's not the best use of additional resources that you might give us.
And in
other districts, it would be.
In a practical way, so just this week, right? So last time we met, we had blended classrooms. We shared that Turner Elementary, which is one of my elementary schools, blends its classrooms. I always have people look at me funny, and then I remind them that it's a National Title Award-winning school while it was in the middle of blended classrooms, right? So they've figured that out. But just this week, we had a conversation about how do we make that local control decision? Do we leave K-1, 2 smaller and make 3, 4, 5 a little bigger or not? And I think that's what you're trying to get to, which is if somebody came to me and said, you mean you need to make your kindergartners three kids smaller, and at the moment in that building, those two kindergarten classes are at 18, right? I don't really need to make them 15, but I could certainly help my 4-5 class, right, with additional support with regard to an aide or, you know, those kinds of questions. I think
that's
what we're trying to talk about.
And I guess still on that same line, to me, it really gets down to that we recognize that the need surrounding class size differs in different districts across the state. And, you know, and yes, we all have the ability to choose within our districts, but I think it's there are different needs.
But I think holding districts accountable to the QEM model to reaching and striving for that is important, because right now it could be hit or miss. Like, well, we really feel like this state this year, grade three is going to be, because they're going to be taking some state test or whatever they decide. It really should be something that guides them, I feel like, towards how they allocate those, you know, like go towards that QEM. And you may already be there. We're not anywhere near it. You know, we think class size should be at 25 in kindergarten in our district, and then we'll bring an assistant in. And that's nowhere near. So I feel like the district gets to make, because our cap size is different than our neighboring school district right now. It's whatever the district decides. So,
but it's based on the resources available to them.
Yes, but they also have in their mind, like in my district in kindergarten, there's 18 in another building and 25 in mine, but it's okay because 25 is what we've said is an okay number, and it's not okay. You know what I mean? And you don't want to shift kids. I get that. But if the control is strictly with each individual district, I have a feeling we're not giving them anything to shoot for. So shooting for the QEM is what I was kind of trying to get
at. So you're suggesting some sort of a tension-type balance where,
yeah,
where you have this ability to have local districts, hey, we need to make these decisions because of specific targets or reasons that we're doing that. But at the same time, the state suggests QEM, which, by the way, suggests this is how much at kindergarten, this is how much at first, this is or some range of those pieces of it. That would make sense.
Mm-hmm. So that's right? The bold part. I mean, that's to Hannah's comment about this is where we're being bold. We're acknowledging local decision-making and choices that are very difficult, but we're also suggesting the goal of working towards something that we know affects many, many of the areas that we care about, including quality teaching, including relationships and feedback models.
And I, Hannah, I think one of the things that we have going for us right now is with the Every Student Succeeds Act, right now every district is going to be looking at creating their local plan. And in that local plan, they should be looking at what are those indicators of school and student success. And is class size one of those things that they should be talking about? What does that look like? What are the other measures that local community really believes are important? I would not be a fan of saying, you know, thou shalt have this class size, because I think that really stifles the ability to be creative and do the right thing in your own district. But I agree with Paula when we're talking about the quality education model. So many people have no idea what it is. They just say, well, that's that big number out there. Well, it's not the number. It is actually demonstrating best practice. What would a prototypical school look like? What do we need to put in place so our students can be successful? And start talking about those things out loud in meetings where everyone can really engage around student success and what that looks like.
Did that help, Richard?
Madam Chair, I could use a little more specific direction in terms of the outline.
Are you on a line now, that particular line? Because I think I liked what was just said. I think that we made the full circle. I think the circle was acknowledging the importance of and the relevance of the discussion being made at the local level about class size because of all the impacts, but allowing for flexibility and creative decisions on FTE choices.
Okay. Well, and this, Hannah, and I truly believe when you have, if when we create the local teams, there are parents, educators, students, everyone's voice is in that room, this will be an issue that will be addressed. Mm-hmm. I mean, whether you don't need it in Cascade necessarily.
Well, we need it. Yeah. There's no question. I got people that will tell me we need it.
Yeah. But how, I think it will come up and it will be something that people will be passionate about. And when we have those conversations about putting the students at the center and saying we want them to be successful, I think we're going to be amazed at what will happen in districts all across the state, not just.
And Hannah gave us a vehicle for this dialogue, which is ESSA local planning. And so that also could be part of that comment, that we acknowledge the importance, we acknowledge the need for creativity at the local level for FTE decisions, but we're also acknowledging the opportunity for ESSA planning on this issue.
Well, QEM.
Right?
QEM. Yes.
Let's you know, we appreciate, I think sometimes there are folks at the local level that imagine school the way it used to be, good, bad, or otherwise, right?
Right.
So, I think an author coined it as nostalgia,
yeah.
Right? So we all went to school, so we think about what it really felt like was really good, but the reality is some of it really wasn't. Mm-hmm. So you have those people at your local level that want to talk about that, but what I think we're also hearing is let's not do away with what the QEM suggests, which is a lot of really good research, mm-hmm. the most current best practice about what we want to do, right? It's a little like suggesting that when I was a child, I still want my doctor to treat me the same way, when in fact that's not what we want to do. I want my doctor now to treat me with the very most current practices. And it's a struggle for some people at the local level to want education to feel the same way. That's a tough one. So if you find that balance, as our colleagues are suggesting, making sure that the QEM is not left out, mm-hmm. you can get there.
Right. I want to make a comment. I know Richard is now starting to feel like, oh my gosh. So it's a situation where I'm hoping that we will all take a real good look at you know, this draft, and that we can, you know, pencil in some things for Richard with a quick email or something, and let him know where we, you know, where you're thinking we've captured what we've discussed and where we still need to flesh it out a little bit. And so we don't have to get it all done right at this moment, but it's one of those things that we hopefully will make an obligation to ourselves to continue to work with Richard on this. Does that make you feel a little bit better?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay.
I have a question
yes.
on that. Can you maybe help us understand the process? Maybe that's at the end of our meeting, the closing
yeah.
remarks, what the process will
right.
be for finishing.
Great. That sounds good. Okay.
Yeah. This is Jeff. Can I have a quick conversation on the line 28. I understand the quality, and you know, teacher piece to, you know, a great teacher in every classroom, and yet when I read through that, if I were a rural teacher, I would get the sense that, wow, they don't think I'm a quality teacher, and so maybe that. Again, in my head, it just sounds better to say there's a teacher recruitment problem sometimes. I mean, teacher, yeah, I don't know. I do understand what you were saying earlier, and again, if I'm a rural teacher, it kind of makes me feel like I'm a little less than.
If you took the adjective out, quality, and I said teacher
yeah,
recruitment.
That'd be my preference.
That sounds good.
I might suggest that the area in the "and" of that line is really covered up in the section one under value of quality educators, and that it's not something that needs to be brought into this section of the report as well. But that's just
yes.
me.
And just
I don't know what you mean.
In the part where it says "and teacher recruitment,"
oh.
I'm kind of a hardcore editor. I would just delete that because I think if you want, you could put it as a C under tell data.
So what if you said in place of what you had just highlighted there, there may be other priorities that would come ahead of reducing class sizes. Sure. Does that make sense?
Sure. Mm-hmm.
Yes, Hannah.
On line 17, you've got OEA question mark TEL survey data. It's the TEL survey is a joint. It's ODE, OEA, COSA, OSBA. So it's not. It's a statewide.
Mm-hmm. I thought somebody would notice that. Yeah.
Is it possible to put that up on OLIS?
Sure.
I think we should do that because I think that's part of our conversation.
I think we have it.
Did
there.
We? I'm not sure. Do yes. we?
Madam Chair,
maybe
I honestly can't remember.
You were on vacation.
Yeah,
I think
maybe that
was.
Okay. All right.
Ms. Terry, on line 27 there, where you're working on in rural areas, says typically smaller class size. I don't know where we're considered rural. We definitely do not have smaller class size. We are 30 plus in most areas. And I'm sure Hermiston and some of the surrounding, I understand small districts, but we're included in rural and we are not that small.
Mm-hmm. So is this a suggestion in places where it says in rural areas to say in smaller districts?
It could be. It just could be. I'm not sure.
And smaller districts, I think, is better than rural
and Riverdale either.
I think in certain circumstances, you might, considering the other superintendents I work with at COSA, that may not be true either.
Okay.
I'm just thinking at the super large
there's,
ones.
There's no way, right. There's no way to, I think, be able to accurately depict.
Yeah.
Because for every, for 7 or 8 small school districts, and I'm talking districts half my size or smaller, you're going to have 1 or 2 that have a problem with that because of, frankly, bad management at the administrative level, right?
So
that's why they're in the middle of trying to fix it.
Maybe parentheses around small, and we took out rural, and we can think about how to...
Some.
To describe some, yeah. Some, actually,
yeah.
You're probably right.
Well, isn't it really saying in districts where they're already
some
reaching
might be
the
QEM, best.
Where they've already, they may put their money... I mean, I don't know, it seems...
Okay. That's an issue. To describe that adequately. I think
some
smaller
does fix the problem.
Yeah, some might do it.
So this is Colin,
yes.
and this might be a procedural thing to kind of help this process along, because I think we could probably try and wordsmith this as we go,
yeah.
But I think our conversation earlier on was very stream of consciousness,
yes.
And I think Richard was doing a really good job at getting kind of the general ideas down, so I wonder if we can kind of maybe go back to that and then have a period of time where we then look at the draft,
mm-hmm.
as opposed to, well, kind of said this, well, let's go back. So I'm not sure if that works for everybody, but that's kind of a thought process.
Colin has given a good idea, especially since we have some folks I know, and Brian has to leave at 10:30, and so let's go ahead and try and get through the next two sections, and if we have time, those of us that can stay can go back also and help a little bit more.
And I've got to assume a draft would come out where we can all put in our 2 cents and...
Sure, yeah. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I will post whatever we conclude with here today, I'll post on OLIS and I'll send out, and it'll be pretty clearly labeled as a working document or a draft or something like that. And then this is not, like,
this
for example, I don't expect the chair will call a vote on this thing.
Right.
So this is not going to be any sort of ratified document done by committee action. The formal thing will be an actual report that we will generate, and then I think that's a better time for wordsmithing.
Okay.
Yeah, when there's actually like a proper document.
And at the end, we're going to talk about our timing and the interest of people to continue working on this. I'm excited. I really feel like some of the ideas that are coming out today gives us a good foundation to do a little bit more tuning and and really further discussion. But we'll have that conversation at the end, if that's okay.
Yeah.
All right. So can we go on then? I think we have fairly well discussed the foundation in number one. And could we go on then maybe to number two? What does it affect?
Everything.
Hannah brought up equity, in a way that I think was really interesting and intriguing and also very important. as far as it's equity, it's openness, but sometime in bringing openness, it's equity is not same. Equity, provides for needs of those individuals or those classes or whatever we're trying to discuss as, a closed opportunity. So, but it doesn't mean same. So I don't know if there's something there you want to add for that, Hannah. I don't know.
I guess what I'm, this Hannah, trying to get at is we've talked a lot about it. We really have. But when it comes time to make the final decisions on where we put the money, we haven't done what we needed to do to address some of those needs. And I don't think it's because people are ill-intended or having ill intent. I think it's that we haven't had access to the resources to be able to do everything. And when it comes down to it, I've been at school board meetings. I know who's there and who's advocating for. And sometimes choices get made that in the end aren't what's best for all students. And we have to find a way to stop that and make sure that all of our students have access.
And this is Anne. What that comes down to is student achievement for students of all backgrounds, right? I mean, I think that's what our goal is, and that's part of graduation rates, but mm-hmm. it's wrapped into a lot of other student experience that comes around that student mm-hmm. achievement.
So student experience, student achievement, maybe as a development of graduation rates?
Madam Chairman of the Committee, is that part of equity, or is that just... Where should I put that in the outline?
I would think it'd be separate, just purely because student achievement is beyond graduation rates. You're talking about achievement at every level, mm-hmm. growth in mm-hmm. typical terms
Absolutely.
Of kids that struggle from point A to point B, and there's growth there. A class size will affect, as I think we talked about earlier, that opportunity. I would put it separately. That's just me.
Anytime you have a list, people look at how did you order that list?
Mm-hmm.
And I that might be a discussion that we want to have further on, making that at least sort of chronologically or have some reason for why we have a list like that. I don't know if you have any dialogue about that now, but that's something we could be thinking about.
It's okay. I'd like to be able to add school culture as well to that list. What we recognized over the last 5 or 6 years as we worked on trying to bring our numbers down was that our culture, building by building, seemed to improve, right? So the conversations we had earlier about there are just too many kids for me to get to leads to a professional who continually wants to do the very best thing that they can, but I think at the end of the day is somehow professionally dissatisfied by their accomplishments. And that, over a long period of time, becomes frustrating. And whether you're a building administrator, a teacher, an aide, or even the great folks that serve our food, if it's a struggle. So when you make adjustments and you feel like you've got the right amount of supports, or at least you begin to attain a level where you have the right amount of supports, mm-hmm. you begin to feel like, as a professional, you're moving forward. And that's a culture issue. We did some rearranging at our high school a couple of years ago with 700 kids in a high school. We had one fight. We had one altercation. One. So that changed the culture of what that building feels like, and it's so much better to come to that place to work, right, when most people feel like they all want to be there for a period of time,
right.
And culture becomes a big thing, and there's a route back to class size,
mm-hmm.
right? I mean, it becomes I cannot get to everything I want to get to,
yeah,
and it manifests itself that way. So,
yes,
I have a question. Actually, this is for Hannah, just because I can't remember, but I know, one of the highest correlations for a highly qualified teacher is length of experience. And I also know that class size could affect teacher retention, but I can't remember if that your data's if data has been gathered in the state of Oregon about that or not. Is teacher retention one of the things that's impacted by class size?
I don't know that we have any specific data that would tell you that, but I can tell you that the what we hear from people is absolutely.
It's interesting then it all loops around to the quality educator, right?
Now, yeah, but it might go, if you look at the TEL data and you look at the new educator, I'm not sure if you could draw that correlation because there are some specific questions about retention for the new, and you might be able to see it there, but for the experience, I don't know if we have any data.
Okay.
We can,
I'm
going to
go look a little.
Paula?
Oh, right before you start. Gary and Jeff, is there any way for you to turn down your volume or mute just a little bit? There's a bunch of feedback.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Paula? I was going to add in that I think the safety letter could have, breaking it out, safety, student safety.
Teacher safety.
Safety of staff. And then
thank you.
Paula? So we were talking about school culture, and I think that's a really great one to add. We spend a lot of time trying to build, and out of necessity, but also desire, to have classroom cultures built. So that's such an important piece, and there's so much evidence out there why that's important. That school culture has really got to start there first. The school's really got to establish that kind of culture so that when you bring it into your classroom, you're all speaking the same language. And those big, big schools and big class sizes, not enough staff, that makes it really, really difficult. I spend every morning, a good part of their day, building culture in our classroom and our community, and we need that because there's so many of us and we have to depend on each other. And I would never give that up no matter how small my class sizes got. I think that's really important, but I think it's more valuable when you have both the school culture as a focus as well as your classrooms together hand in hand on that.
This is Colin. Under the relationships piece, I'd like to make sure we talk about relationships outside the school building with parents. With community members, because when you've got a class of 40-something and you want to do something with a local business, it's a lot harder than if you say, I want to bring in 15 or 18 kids to go through a tour of some kind. So,
other comments on anything that has to do with how it class site affects important issues that we find in our classroom for good quality teaching and for good learning and diversity of learning opportunities and experiences?
On line 21, the space issue, it's more than access to materials. I mean, in some cases, it's just, I mean, this is actually, I guess, part of the safety item, just, you know, getting close to fire codes or having enough desks or, but that idea that you just need so much space for physical students and, you know, 40 in a room is going to change that dynamic between students as well as with the teacher. And
It also limits opportunities for small group activities and for a variety of enrichment activities and even observation activities. Mm-hmm. I remember in the class of 42, you know, you had 8 small groups instead of 4 or 5 small groups, and trying to get them in a space where they could feel like they were, you know, having the ability to even hear each other.
Yeah, I've seen elementary classrooms. This is Anne, where it's like, well, we can't have circle time anymore because it's just too many kids for the rug, and there's too many desks because our rug space has gotten so small. Sort of things that are just part of running a room that are not an option anymore due to the physical limitations of the room.
Physical limitations of the room. That's a good comment, Hannah.
Yeah, and I think it goes as far as there's not a seat. For a student, how welcoming is that when you walk in and it's, well, all the seats are taken today, you're going to be on the heater. And I'm not making that up. That's the reality in some places where students don't have an actual seat, and that's just...
If you read the absentee report, and I know a lot of us, we didn't do it in the group, but we've all seen it. To me, the engagement aspect, you know, dealing with how it relates, how do you engage? Why do people want to be there? You know, I had one student come back in a larger senior class, and it was like, I didn't think you'd even miss me, or I didn't think you'd even notice that I was gone. And I just looked at him one day and went, what are you talking about? You know, of course I noticed you were gone. And he said, well, sometimes it just feels like, you know, how could you notice me? You know, there's so many people in here. How could you notice me? And so, again, I just think the relationship between, again, how welcoming, you know, how the opportunity is there for the teacher to involve themselves with the student, you know, really we've got to talk about absenteeism and why are they not there?
We don't have student engagement up there. I mean, it does affect student engagement. It's hard to get all kids engaged if there's so many in a room. And engagement's a huge part of their academics and learning.
Can you go down a little bit when you get through that? This isn't about... This is Hannah. This isn't about teachers. This is about students. But for it does impact educators. So talking with a teacher from an elementary school who had 34, and she's saying, I'm doing everything I can, Hannah. I know I'm reaching 30 of them. I feel really good. Two, I'm a little iffy. And two, that's what keeps me up at night because I don't have the ability to meet their needs, and I don't know what to do, and I want to be able to do that. And that, so there's all that pressure that goes into your responsibility. And when you talk about accountability in public education, well, of course, educators, they have that internal accountability to each and every one of those students. So there is that ability to actually do what you love to do, and that is teach students.
Richard, Hannah's comment there, I think, really really talked about, again, the idea that the teacher is feeling like they're not succeeding because they have that personal accountability of wanting to do better for every student in the classroom. And it's affected by who's in the classroom and how many are in the classroom. So we can, again, add to any of these if there's more that folks, you know, think about. I think we've captured generally the ones that we've discussed or people brought stories about. Does anybody else see anything, some kind of a gap or a gaping hole?
And it's not a hole at all. I think if we could summarize in some way some of the stories that came out of the public testimony, I think those are the stories that we tell, I think, are the strongest thing we can get out there sometimes. And I think, and I watched on the live stream, so I called in and I was watching and listening on the live stream, and I just think those are so powerful that we need to share those.
Okay. Thank you. So connection to the stories and acknowledgement of the stories.
It might be a whole other, I mean, I don't know if it's a whole other section or if you just want to block quote things out from time to time.
Mm-hmm. It's a good idea.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, should it be another section or should we, I could see it being, you know, kind of pulled out or it could be like an appendix in and of itself.
That's might be a way to go.
What do you guys feel? Should it be another section or an appendix or where do you think it should be?
I'd recommend putting it in as a separate section right now, and then as we go through this and maybe reorganize it a bit as we think about it more, maybe it fits in somewhere else, or but at least getting it on the paper right now.
Yes. And
I would agree with that. I think as the report comes out, when we make recommendations or when we're sharing information to back it up with, here's, it makes it really powerful, and we want to make sure people see that, because whether it's a parent comment or a teacher parent or a parent comment, student comment, people need to see that there's passion around this. People came to testify, and we want to honor that.
There are real people.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I hope that, you know, for if we throw it in the appendix for now, I hope that as editors, we look at those comments with an eye towards which sections of this report do they support, so that we can sprinkle it throughout, because as a report reader, I know it's easy to skip the appendix, and I would not want our readers to do that.
Right. Absolutely. Thank you. So then trying to go on to three then. How do we acknowledge the importance of class sizes?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I just turned three into four.
Okay, so it's number four now.
Four, yeah.
So number four. This is the list that I'm the least happy with, because I don't know, I just didn't want to assume I knew what you were thinking, but I wanted to have something down there that we would at least start talking about. You know, when how it, you know, how it affects the teaching style, how it affects the, you know, teaching opportunity, how it affects the learning opportunity, different types of learning styles. You know, I mean, there's a lot of all of that, but I didn't know exactly where you wanted to go here. So I'm open.
Can you help me understand a little bit more? I was trying to listen pretty hard. What your objective in this section was?
The objection.
Yeah.
I'm objecting to 40 years worth of discussion on. No, not really. I'm teasing. So here I go. I want the report to mean something. And it seems to me that one of the things that we've constantly said, even with Hannah's comment today about let's be bold, we just keep switching this down to 113 as far as class size, because we know it's a financially challenging area. And we also are trying to figure out smaller fixes on how to deal with some of the other outcomes rather than deal with the, you know, the actual cause of some of these outcomes. And I want to acknowledge that class size is really the cause of many of these things that we say are important in both quality education and in opportunity and access to good learning in our Oregon schools. How do we capture that?
So I'm going to ask just because I'm slow. Is it part of you're trying to quantify it as in terms of what our vision or our goal is?
Goal and next steps.
Okay.
So goal and next steps. You know, do we rethink or relook at blended classrooms? Do we really concentrate on the differences of age of student for different reasons it's affecting that classroom opportunity, access, and opportunity for quality, you know, teaching? You know, do we acknowledge the importance of the special needs as Hannah did today, as far as, again, are we kicking the can, you know, down? We know we need equity, we know we need access, but for different populations that means different things.
This is Jerry.
Yes.
I really appreciate your remarks about the effect on style of teaching. you have a class of 36, your style is going to be drastically changed from a class of 25. Just through logistics or even the accomplishments of the kids, just for the fact you cannot touch every kid every period.
Thank you.
Darren,
yes.
I guess the conversation for me would be kind of what Hannah said very early on. If you're going to be bold about it, then you have acknowledged the importance of class size by what we've just been talking about. For me, as a conclusion, it would be, you know, now is the time. This is the time we can have multiple conversations, debates, however you want to put it, about all the issues that surround this. But at the end of the day, right, class size affects all the things we just got done talking about. Put your money where your mouth is, right? Make it so that the quality education model is the standard by which Oregon looks at its students and says, this is what we're going to provide for you. And you can talk about all the other pieces later, but I almost sometimes feel like that a conclusion is a succinct, quick, clear conversation supported by all the things we already said. Mm-hmm. That's for me. Now, you can rehash all the other things, and I think I get what you're trying to accomplish, which is let's not forget all these pieces.
Right.
But then you can get into the age of student or special needs, and we can have long conversations, and I'm sure we can have our own set of debates just about that stuff.
Yeah.
I'm to the point where when somebody says to me, if that's an issue, then the issue is, let's just solve it by saying, get to the QEM and let's be done with it. Let's quit having conversations around all the other pieces to the puzzle.
Well, I love that.
I agree. And to me, these bullet points, if we feel like they need further discussion, I would like to throw them earlier in the report. And this should be the area where we succinctly say, this is what we know is important for Oregon students, and that we recommend that our state commit to that,
okay,
providing that.
I think it's become fairly clear, right? I mean, I know that COSA, I know that Oregon School Boards Association would be very clearly behind, obviously, right? Mm-hmm. Being able to say the quality education model is not something we aspire someday, eventually, after 40 years to get to.
Right.
It's something that watching a generation, you know, I think you said, Paula, that your child, you know, they started talking about it, she's already out,
yeah,
right? And same for mine. So that's been 11 years now. I'm waiting around for that to happen. We keep trying to figure out how to piecemeal it together. Okay, let's solve it. And why are we not like, why do we aspire to be like Alabama or Mississippi instead of being like Connecticut or Vermont or somewhere else that seems to say this is an important piece to the puzzle for our community?
Yes, Hannah.
And I would just, I agree, and I think it's laying out the vision and the hope for what it can be, what we can accomplish, and what all students can have access. So if we want to point out in that vision that there are, that we're addressing the specific needs of our students who are living in poverty or of our communities of color that we haven't done, you can do that. But the vision is, hey, look what we can do when we truly address this issue.
Mm-hmm. I like it. So, and my feeling from what I just heard is that we'll turn three into more of a vision statement of what we want to accomplish and really connect it strongly to the quality education model. Is that fair? Okay.
Madam Chair, move. Do you want to keep these specific examples of things that right now I have listed as 4C? In this conclusion area, or Ms. Bryan said
no,
somewhere else?
Okay. Those, I think actually what they've said, we're being redundant. Most of those are captured in what we talked about in two,
mm-hmm,
and other different elements, or even in one as far as definition.
Yeah.
Okay. And this, Hannah, and I'm not sure the blended classes, what the conversation has been around that and the impact. So I don't know what that is. I didn't see it up above, but if there's something particular that a committee member wanted there, then I think just making sure that we get that in there.
It was really around, you know, are there different concerns about, it was sort of teacher-student ratio around needs in a blended classroom is
okay,
kind of where it was.
And the teacher's ability to provide the learning instruction at multiple grade levels.
And where it works, it's amazing.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. It absolutely. When you've got people and that's their, they've got that skill.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. So how do you feel, before we go to some other issues, but how do you feel about just the rough draft? Do you feel like we've got something to work with and something for Richard and Nicole is going to help too and assist with looking and helping us on with looking at those stories on OLIS and a lot of things? But we'll get something out to you on this draft, and then we'll now talk about the process of what's next. I want to acknowledge that if there's anybody, and we do have someone here in the audience, that public hearing after that, I can have a public hearing if there's anybody who would like to add anything. I put it on the agenda in case anybody had anything they'd like to add from the public. So now we have choices to make, and I'm a new chair, and I ask questions about, okay, they only gave us a month and a half to do this work. And so now what are our opportunities? And our opportunities is that we could give a report out in the September deadline and use the ideas that we had there and be done. Or we could actually take the opportunity to continue talking about some of this conclusion of the quality education model. How do we forward the quality education model? How do we forward the conversation of this report to the legislature or to others that might want to do something that is more action-driven, and that we could go forward with that conversation between September and November, or September and early December? And I wanted to find out from the committee where your interest lies, or if you're, I know how many committee meetings you guys go to, and I know how busy your lives are, but would you be willing to be part of that? Would you be willing to go forward with more very maybe engaged on a particular aspect of the report or a particular idea for taking next steps with the conclusion? But I'd like to see what the feel of the committee is.
Yes.
The words yes?
To just put out a report, I don't think is enough. We need to follow it up. We need to, when budgets are being set, come back to this and say, fund the QEM. It's time. We've been talking about it long enough. I don't want to talk about it anymore. I just want to do it.
Okay. Yes.
And I, yes, Hannah. But I think, again, going back to the QEM, it's like doing some education around what the QEM actually is, so that people understand that when you say the QEM, I don't think people have read the report. I don't think they understand what's really in there. And it would be great, any opportunity that we have to help educate legislators and community leaders and even educators. I mean, I try to do as much as I can to get that out there, but letting people know what it is and what Oregon could look like. And I'll bring ESSA up again, because we should be using that information to help us in this work. And I think there's that fear of, no, because that's just a number, needs to go away, and we need to talk about what are our hopes and dreams for our students, and is the QEM where we want to go? Mm-hmm.
So I've heard two folks basically say there's more dialogue that we could have, that it could be powerful because we could be an active body that is going forward with either education messages or with messages of what to do on the budget, or with trying to engage and connect to the opportunity of ESSA. Those are some of the things I've heard so far. Anybody want to add to that?
Well, I guess I just wanted to clarify. It sounded to me like there were two questions. One is, are we delivering an interim report, or do we feel like we are ready to deliver a report? And I think that largely comes down to you and staff and how quickly we can get. And then what follow-up support are you looking for from us? And I can sense the engagement of this committee in terms of their interest in this issue and how dedicated we are to it. So I think the answer, at least for me, would also be yes. Whatever we need to do to make this report get traction, I think would be important.
Agreed.
Okay. So, Richard and Nicole, have indicated they believe that we can get an interim report ready to hand out by the 16th of September. And so that what that means, though, that we'd have to have in the next 2 weeks some kind of an email dialogue, or we'd have to have maybe one phone in, you know, meeting or something of that nature to be able to do that?
Madam Chair, you mean to formally approve the
report? To go through the draft and...
Yeah, the phone, to do any sort of like approval and vote on it has to be ideally in the room, but phone would be permissible too.
Okay. So is there a goal then from the committee that we go forward with asking staff to turn this around, a rough draft that we can get out on email and that we can work on drafting? I've only been in one other committee where we've done that. It was 2860. And basically they would send it out. We would send in comments. They would write up drafts. And they would change it. Then they would send it out again. We'd write up comments and then turn it back. Does that work?
Sure.
Mm-hmm. It's okay?
Yeah.
So staff is agreeing to be part of this, a very big part of this process?
Yes.
Okay. All right. So is that, and then as far as next meeting, you know, actual and next meeting, I think we have to see how quickly we turn this report around. And I wouldn't want a next meeting until we were ready to vote. And so we can get dates out to you. I know folks who are going back to school or who already are back in school that we're going to have to deal with that, but we'll be creative. And either Nicole and or Richard will be in contact. Does that make sense? Okay. So I now want to honor my public hearing, if there's anybody who would like to speak to that before I... So would you like to come up? And
please,
oh, I have to. Okay, excuse me. The work session is closed, and now we're going to open the public hearing officially. And Lori, would you like to come up and speak to us? And your name for the record.
Good morning, Committee and Chair McLean. For your record, Lori Wimmer, representing the Oregon Education Association. And as you asked me early on in this process, I've been watching, and I wanted to just offer my assistance to the committee if you choose to accept it with some elements of this. We've been tracking this issue for a very long time on behalf of our members. And one of my jobs has been to be a lead person on this issue. One of the things I wanted to point out was the link between funding and our opportunity that may be unique right now with a ballot measure that would help us actually achieve the quality education model for the first time since its inception. And I think it would be useful to at least acknowledge that there are opportunities on the revenue side that would help on the budget side to actually meet the goals of the quality education model with respect to class size and other critical supports for our students. The second thing that I would point out is that educational researchers often reflect on the class size issue with respect to how to do it, not just whether to do it. Charles Achille, who was one of the lead researchers on the Tennessee STARS project, once told a group of us in a conference that he would argue that there is educationally sound class size reduction and there's political class size reduction. And educationally sound means you have a qualified teacher in front of the students and it's a small group of students. Political class size reduction is any warm body, and it's a ratio issue. And you have people who are not qualified, and he pointed to the California experiment with class size reduction as an example of one that did not yield the kind of results you would expect in terms of student success because of the way they approached the issue, trying to do it on the cheap, in effect. A third piece would be some research that we have seen. Richard Rothstein, who's another education researcher on a variety of education topics, once told me about some research he was doing in, I think it was New Jersey schools, or it could have been New York City. And they were in elementary schools looking at various different approaches for a strict ratio system. And they took 40 kids and they put two licensed teachers in a room of 40 kids. And they started having all sorts of complaints about moodiness and behavior issues, both the staff and the kids, headaches, fatigue, difficulty concentrating, all those things. And he was sharing that with an engineering friend of his who said, well, has anybody done a CO2 level check in that room? And sure enough, what it was too many bodies exhaling in a small classroom, and they were having CO2 sickness. And so then they decided they would open the windows. Well, they had buses who were keeping their engines going, so now they were getting the exhaust fumes from the bus. So they were having struggles of how to actually manage the air quality so kids could learn. So it might be that part of your conversation literally goes to the logistics of how you do class size reduction, if you do class size reduction. So that those are pieces that I could share with you and your staff if you'd like as a part of your appendix or what have you. I'd also bring to your attention a wonderful report done by OPB Radio not too long ago. Rob Manning was the reporter, and he actually went into some of our members' school rooms, or the classrooms, and I'll never forget one student. I looked at research on this for many, many years, but never encountered the kind of comment that this student brought to my attention through this report. She was saying, you know, when I don't understand a difficult science concept, and this is in a class, a biology class in Beaverton of 60 kids, I, you know, in the old days could raise my hand and say, hey, I don't get it. Can we go over that again? But when there are 60 students in the class, I'm too shy. I'm too embarrassed. I'm not going to raise my hand. So for that student, learning opportunity was missed. And so it's something that is difficult to capture with data, and data often is difficult to tell the whole story. Anecdotes do color in the lines a little bit for us. And I thought that story was pretty telling. And students can often give us a lot of insight that we don't otherwise have when we think we're paying attention to all the elements of what the implications are of classes that are too big. The last thing I wanted to say is that we have right now, and I'm sure a lot of you are aware of this, a class size safety issue across the state of Oregon that has reached nearly crisis proportions in many places in the state. And there are a lot of elements that have come together to create this perfect storm, but class size is, especially at the elementary level, certainly a piece of that puzzle. When students, particularly those who've not had the opportunity to have a preschool experience and aren't yet acclimated to classroom settings and sitting still and cooperating with their classmates and so on, also maybe coming from trauma and having some issues at home, come into class sizes that are too big, they're much more likely to have behavior issues that cause room clears and all kinds of other, again, impediments not only to that student's learning but to the classmates. And so I just wanted to make sure that on your record for your report that you address some of those implications right here in Oregon that have a link to class size and why it's such an urgent need to bring special focus to it. And I thank you so much for your work. Back in 2012, we did a little internal study of our members on what they are coping with as a result of the funding crises that have been so pervasive and persistent in Oregon. And I went home every night after reading these wonderful, heartrending comments from our members, and I would cry myself to sleep because it was so poignant. And over again, class size and implications to the kinds of things I'm talking about were really making our members despondent. And as we emerge out of the economic crisis, we will get so far, but not far enough. And so thank you so much for your work.
Thank you very much for coming and being part of the process. I appreciate it.
Sure.
And please get any information you want put to the report to Richard.
Okay.
Thank you. Any other comments or questions or issues for the good of the order? I really want to thank all of you who have been so faithful. I really appreciate you being here, and thank you for calling in. Thank you, Gary. Thank you, Jeff. And really appreciate all the effort, energy, and onward and upward is what I'm hoping we will do as a committee. So thank you very much. Do you have anything else for the good of the order?
No,
okay. Then we're going to adjourn the meeting for today. Thank you.
Thank you.
Adjourn the meeting for today. Thank you.
Thank you.
Going to adjourn.